all of the information that makes up who you are, it's all for sale, either by these data brokers or by crooks who are running these types of identity theft services.
A huge credit bureau unwittingly sold people's financial information to an identity thief. It's 2013. Do you know where your data are? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When tragedy strikes, the media rush to put the victims and their families in the spotlight, for better or for worse.
A lot of times, media wants to see emotion, and I personally just made a decision in the early days not to perform for the camera.
Also, we continue our ongoing investigation into the Department of Homeland Security's lack of transparency.
Travelers have legitimate questions about this process. So if the government isn't willing to talk to reporters, then that's effectively saying we're not making it clear to the public.
That and more coming up after this.
Jad, we've invited you here for a testimonial because you've worn one of my hats. And you are actually going to be using one of my hats as a pledge premium for your program.
First of all, I can't quite wrap my brain around how it is. Like, I've seen you here at 3 in the morning. Like, yeah, that's a normal everyday thing. And I'm like, how in the world do you have time to make a hat? But I guess you're doing it, like, nervously while you're editing and stuff like that?
During editorial meetings. You know, they're not skilled. They look like they're made by a real amateur. I only know two stitches.
No.
Make hats.
You're just being bashful when you say that. They're actually really cool. They're, like, they've got patterning. They look like something a Williamsburger would wear and look very cool in. What does someone have to do to get that awesome hat?
Well, our development people priced it at $500 per hat.
Hell, I would pay twice that to get a hat made by Brooke Gladstone. Are you effing kidding me? That's amazing. Seriously, I'm not just blowing smoke here. That's pretty awesome. You're
going to
get so much
and
more than $500 worth of social cred when you're like, you know who made this hat on my head right now? Brooke fucking Gladstone made this hat. Are you kidding me?
Okay, all right. You're going a little over the top here.
I'm serious.
I've got a picture of you in one, and you can find it on our website and on your website. Radiolab.org and onthemedia.org.
Just love that. Come on. That is the greatest pledge gift ever. I'm jealous. That's just on record. I am jealous that you thought of that.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Let's just stipulate that our personal information, where we go, what we do, what we buy, is the currency of the internet. Brokering that data is a billion-dollar business, the stock and trade of companies both legitimate and not. Companies that sell your social security numbers, bank routing numbers, right down to your mother's maiden name, so that your identity can be easily, profitably stolen. Ryan Krebs reports on security news at his website, KrebsOnSecurity.com. This week, he uncovered the story of how Experian, one of the three major credit bureaus, a massive repository of millions of people's financial history, unwittingly sold its data to an outfit that facilitates identity theft. It's a complicated story, starting with some strange codes attached to stolen data Krebs got from an identity theft outfit called SuperGet.info. Those codes were ultimately traced to a legitimate data brokerage firm called US InfoSearch. And I'll let Brian pick it up from there.
Well, I called up the CEO of US InfoSearch, and he said he'd been contacted by the US Secret Service and that federal agents were investigating Experian as the source of this information. The CEO of US InfoSearch explained that his firm had struck an information sharing agreement with another data aggregator, a company called Court Ventures.
So how is Court Ventures connected?
Well, Court Ventures was acquired by Experian in early 2012 because of their extensive consumer database. And at some point, the guys running this SuperGet.info identity theft site posed as a private investigator in the U.S. looking up records via Court Ventures, a.k.a. Experian.
Mm-hmm.
And he also told me that they routinely paid for the information that they were looking up using wire transfers from Singapore.
Most people don't pay that way.
Most people don't pay via wire transfers, and they certainly don't come from Singapore, particularly if they're supposed to be a legitimate U.S. organization. This should have thrown up some big red flags for Experian.
So how do we know that these crooks used Experian's data?
I don't have enough data at this point to say definitively that they didn't, because frankly, Experian has declined to offer much information. There has to be another way of getting these companies to divulge information about their information collection practices and what sort of access consumers actually have to the information that's being collected about them. Majority of Americans, unless they have a problem with their credit or they have, God forbid, an identity theft problem, they probably don't have a reason to interact with companies like Experian. They probably don't even know that companies like Experian are collecting their information.
Last year, the FTC called on data brokers to give consumers access to their own information through an easy-to-use common portal. How did that work out? And what else is the FTC trying to do?
Well, that hasn't worked out so well. There have been a couple of data brokers that have put up pages on their sites that allow people to remove their information or to opt out of having their information. But the processes involved are so onerous that very few people are going to undertake them. You have to get signed copies or notarized copies of different documents. You have to basically send them every piece of information about you that they may not already have and hope that at the end of the day that they're going to follow through on that request in a timely way.
Is there a requirement that these data companies at least tell us when they've been breached?
Yes. There are laws on the books in 48 states and the District of Columbia that generally require companies that hold information on U.S. consumers to provide notice to those consumers if their information has been compromised.
This is weird. 48 states, but it's not a national law.
This is one of my biggest pet peeves here, Brooke. It's hard to find a security issue that is more bipartisan and has more support from the technology community at large than the push to enact a national data breach disclosure law. They've been asking for this for almost a decade now, and Congress hasn't seen fit to put whatever effort they need to put into it to actually pass this law, let alone get into additional privacy protections for consumers. I think the real story here is that all of the information that makes up who you are, as far as creditors are concerned, it's all for sale, either by these data brokers or by crooks who are running these types of identity theft services. How do we get past using these things that are supposed to be private, you know, SSN, mother's maiden name, etc., as de facto identifiers, right? Because they're not private anymore. And anybody who pretends they are hasn't been paying attention to what's been going on in the last couple of years.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much.
Brian Krebs does his investigations at KrebsOnSecurity.com. Aviva Litan is a fraud and security analyst at the research firm Gartner. I got in touch with her to ask just how big of a deal this Experian breach is.
So this is a very big deal because they have data on all our credit history, all our financial transactions, all our addresses, our utility bills, our telephone bills. So basically our whole financial history.
What does the breach show us about the security practices of these large data brokers?
We do need a paradigm shift in the way we're securing consumer data, like a radical change. Right now it's just patchwork and making do with old systems. And frankly, even encryption doesn't work anymore. There was a revelation a few weeks ago that the NSA had asked RSA, a security firm, to basically put a backdoor in one of their encryption algorithms so that the NSA could listen to encrypted communications. So even encrypting information doesn't work anymore against governments, perhaps against criminals as well.
But most of us have received at some point or other a call from a credit card company saying, did you make this purchase? At least making an effort to follow up on the possibility of breaches and identity theft?
Yeah, you raise an excellent point. With credit cards and payments, we needed to bring merchant banks and consumer banks together, and that happened in the form of MasterCard and Visa. They connected all these parties. The credit card industry actually has instituted a lot of good fraud protection controls and also data security controls. The banks don't want to eat the fraud on your credit card. When it comes to identity data, like the data housed by the credit bureaus, There's no similar private sector mechanism to create these standards and incentives to stop the theft.
Aviva, let me see if I've got this right. What you're saying is that credit card companies had to eat the consequences of wrongfully made purchases from people's stolen credit cards. And so they implemented effective security measures. These kind of measures don't exist when individuals' identities are stolen. Is it because there's insufficient motivation? If the burden fell on the bank, do you think we'd have better security?
100%. And that's why we have to wake up our government and Congress to enforce legislation to make the banks responsible, so that if the mortgage company issues a loan to someone who stole your identity, then that bank should be responsible for issuing that loan. They always try to get the money back from the consumer. So the onus is on the victim to prove themselves innocent. Identity theft is a small portion of loan loss to these banks. But if the person's broke, then they eat the loss. So they have reserves for it on their balance sheet. So there's really no incentive for them to change their ways of doing business.
So how do we prove we're innocent?
That just takes years of writing to the different credit bureaus, writing to the different banks, trying to clear up your record. There is a whole industry now that's there to help people recover from identity theft. In fact, Experian offers a service. They sell you monitoring services and remediation services.
Wow.
You know, well, this is a case where consumers need protections. It's not a level playing field, and the FTC really does have to step up to the plate. They've been talking about it for years. They've been talking about a federal breach disclosure law. They've been talking about identity theft protection, and just nothing's happened.
Aviva, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For nothing.
I'm really not exaggerating this. Take care.
Aviva Litton is a fraud and security analyst at Gartner. And here's a word to the wise from Experian.
At any minute, you could be a victim of fraud. Most people don't even know it. Fraud could mean lower credit scores, higher loan rates, and maybe not getting the car you want.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about the New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. About a month ago, we aired a piece from our producer, Sara Abdurrahman, that generated a huge response. It was about her and her friends and her family's frightening and unexplained detention at the U.S. border post at Niagara Falls on a return trip from a wedding in Toronto. They are all American citizens. Here's an excerpt.
After we had been there about 5.5 hours, a man came out, put handcuffs on me, and took me to a back room that was basically a jail cell. They didn't tell me what was going on. My only request is I just asked one of them, whenever you guys find out what's going on, can you please just tell my family? Can you just inform my family?
While Khalid was still in the jail cell, the rest of his group got their passports back and were told they could leave. Here's his wife, Ella.
The agent tells me, oh, he won't be joining you guys. There's an agency coming to pick him up. I was like, well, what agency? He's like, I can't disclose that information with you. I was like, he's my husband. You need to tell me where he is going. We waited here 6 hours. We're American citizens. Don't treat us like we're criminals. Don't treat us like we've done something wrong. And he made it seem like it was the FBI coming to get him, like this was something serious. And then I just broke down.
Turned out, Khalid had an unpaid ticket for having a crooked license plate, which he got back in 2006.
That part of the story was about some friends also returning from the wedding, also citizens, who had been stopped the same day at the Detroit border post. No explanation, just hours of detention in a purposely cold room, device searches, and dread. Sarah told Brooke,
"How naive was I to think that when we came back into the country, all smiles and happy to be home, that this wouldn't happen? You know, you always hear this over and over and over again. You don't do anything wrong. You've got nothing to hide. You're fine. And I really thought, if there's due process, if there's a legal system, and I haven't done anything wrong, then nobody will treat me that way. And if somebody does treat me that way, there's going to be some sort of accountability later for that. And what I'm discovering is there's nothing that any of us can do. Absolutely nothing."
Despite repeated attempts, Sarah never reached anyone within the relevant government agencies for clarity about their policies. In the face of our utter failure to get answers from DHS, we sought some insight from experts. Susan Stellan is a contributor to the New York Times, and Christopher Sherman is the Rio Grande Valley correspondent for the Associated Press. Both Susan and Chris regularly report about and interact with agencies within the Department of Homeland Security.
I tend to write about travel, so the two areas where I have had the most experience with DHS is either TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, or CBP, Customs and Border Protection.
And I'm based here in McAllen, Texas, at the Texas-Mexico border. So naturally, I write a lot about immigration and border security. So on a very regular basis, I deal with Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol, as well as some of the other agencies, such as Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That's part of covering any massive federal bureaucracy, is learning how to navigate it.
And once you figured it out, it was totally smooth sailing, right?
What I've noticed has really been in the last year or so, some information that previously had been provided really without any hesitation, suddenly it was, what's your story about? Who else are you interviewing? How do these statistics or this data fit into your story? You know, they're free to ask those questions, and I'm free not to answer them, but oftentimes it delayed the process, and these weren't stories where you would expect them to be especially sensitive, and I was asking for things that I used to get really without any question.
Just about a year ago, I was able to get, you know, an executive director at the agency on the phone. They knew it wasn't just going to be easy questions. From there, it's really changed where it's been very difficult to get someone to do an actual interview. I've been asked to send the topics in advance. There is a point where it does tip over into feeling like the motivation is really to find out what the angle of the story is and get as much information about it, even though at the end of that process, the answer is, we can't make someone available for an interview. Here's a statement that says, everything we do is about keeping Americans safe. Travelers have legitimate questions about this process. What are your rights? What do you have to do? So if the government isn't willing to talk to reporters and clarify what these policies are, then that's effectively saying, we're not making it clear to the public. You know, it may be no one wants to talk about it because there really isn't a policy to point to.
There have been situations where there's been a line of communications with contacts at an agency over a period of time. You may even have a contact locally who has said, okay, we can do the interview. And then the night before it's supposed to happen, you get a phone call saying, I'm sorry, this interview is no longer approved.
As a person who does this day to day, do you wake up in the morning and go,
It's frustrating, definitely. But if you have enough information from other sources for the story, sometimes the fact that the government won't comment on it or agency officials won't comment on it, that speaks volumes to me. So something gets across even though there wasn't an answer to your question.
Mm-hmm.
From their perspective, I sometimes wonder why that choice is being made, because now the official spokesperson is completely out of the story, and we're talking to retired agents, or we're speaking with agents who have requested anonymity because they fear retaliation, or you end up talking to a union representative who feels safer speaking on the record. And I've heard in private conversations with agents here locally that they would like to have their voice there. They would like to be speaking on some of these subjects. But somewhere up the chain, it's getting shut down.
The other issue I would say that is more frustrating for me is making the effort to reach someone via email, phone calls, being sent to multiple people. And then after the article appears, there's been a couple times where I've then heard from someone, as Chris said, higher up the food chain, who says, I'm shocked and disappointed we weren't given the opportunity to comment.
Since you say the stories get out there, what is the public missing because of DHS opacity?
A better understanding of why some of these policies exist, why some decisions are made, because we're not allowed to have these conversations with the people who are actually making the decisions. At times, the low-level agents in the field seem as mystified by some of these things as I am.
Policies or by the lack of responsiveness?
Some of both. I've received questions from agents about policies. You know, it's not entirely clear to them why they're doing something a certain way.
The justification, I think, for not talking about a lot of things is, well, for security reasons, we can't talk about that. I think to give one counterexample, I would say that with the Transportation Security Administration, there was such an outcry over screening procedures, the pat-downs, the x-ray machines, that ultimately they did engage the media much more. That did lead to some opening up and discussions of policies, and in some cases rolling back certain policies, like the removal of x-ray machines from domestic airports.
How do you think your reporting would be different if the DHS and its associated agencies were more forthcoming?
It opens up potentially a broader discussion about, you know, is this the correct policy or is this a necessary policy? It used to be you could basically sashay across the border. And now we are moving toward a time when everybody has these passports that have a chip in them. And when you pass through, all this data comes up on you. So this idea of protecting the border, what are we trying to accomplish here? How much money is being spent on it? And what are the costs just to privacy and civil rights that we're accepting?
So you can't have these larger discussions about these policies if you can't get a clear idea of what they are, how much they cost, what their impact is, and so on.
Well, I think you can. It's just not a fully informed discussion. I mean, I think Sarah's broadcast really generated a discussion. People were really surprised at what had happened to her and her family. Stories like that, I think, do then prompt members of Congress to take a look at things. That's been the case with some of the things that I've written about. Other media outlets report on it. So I don't know that it really shuts down this opportunity to have a broader conversation, but to have a fully informed conversation that's based on data and information, that's the part that's harder.
So you do what you can to try to form a better relationship, a more trusting relationship, because you don't want to reach that step where it truly is a standoff and you're finding yourself filing FOIAs every day. Once you take that step, you know it's going to be several months before you get your information. That's not to say I don't file FOIAs on a regular basis, but you really don't want to get to the point where you have to do that for things that have been given to you in the past without the slightest hesitation.
The main thing that they can hold back is data about things. You can write about a topic and you can find experts or people who are in the public who experience things. But it's more, I think, to get those numbers and to get the real facts about policies that does diminish the quality of what you can write about.
And that's the stuff that we usually end up having to file FOIAs for.
So after doing this coverage for so long, when you put in that request, do you still have just a glimmer of hope that you just might this time get a response?
Yeah, I do. You know, it would become more difficult to come to work every day if you really didn't think there was any chance.
Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
Chris Sherman is the Rio Grande Valley correspondent for the Associated Press. Susan, thank you too.
Thank you, Brooke.
Susan Stellan is a contributor to the New York Times. Currently, congressional oversight of the vast DHS bureaucracy is divided among dozens of House and Senate subcommittees, all of which seem to get into each other's way. That's according to former congressman and current member of the U.S. Homeland Security Advisory Council, Lee Hamilton. Nevertheless, he says that if he were Sarah, Congress would be the first place he'd go.
I would go to my representatives. I'd say, look, this is outrageous. I was treated poorly. I tried to get it corrected. They didn't do anything about it. I want you to write a letter to the Secretary of DHS. I want you to make sure that in hearings, the bureaucrats are asked about this and why it happened.
In response to our producer, Sarah Abdurrahman's experience at the border, we've gotten comments from people around the country. Does it work if you're approaching your congressman on behalf of someone else?
There's always more political pressure in greater numbers. So you want to organize the people who are complaining. You want to contact as many members of Congress as possible. Pressure, that's what you have to do. You have to create pressure in the Congress and pressure against the DHS to perform properly. That's part of the process. It happens every single day, or at least it should, in a representative democracy.
So how to apply pressure to the Department of Homeland Security? How easy is it for constituents to contact so many members of Congress? Well, WNYC's data news guru John Keefe has created a tool for OTM listeners to do just that. John, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure.
What did you build?
Well, we just made a very simple little tool. It's actually an advocacy calling system run by Mobile Commons. We're using it a little bit differently for journalistic purposes, and we've loaded in the names of the representatives who are on the House Committee on Homeland Security and the House Judiciary Committee. And if one of those folks is your representative, when you click on the button, we will call you, and then we will call your representative. If your representative isn't on one of these committees, it will connect you with somebody else who is on that committee.
This is done with a mouse click, right?
It's a simple mouse click on this form. And then what we did is we made it so you can be the reporter. In fact, we have the questions to ask the folks who answer at the congressional offices. We have three questions for you, and you get to report in to us what your representative or another representative who you reached, what their office says in response to these questions.
All right. Now, John, I have to ask this question. This sounds like a wonderful crowdsourcing of journalism, and, you know, I'm all for it, of course. But it also has echoes of what they call astroturfing, where in order to create the appearance of a grassroots movement, organizations will get a number of people to click on a button or fill out a form, and all of a sudden they're represented as an angry population with pitchforks and flaming torches.
Well, the reason it seems that way is that this is exactly the kind of tool that is used for exactly that kind of astroturfing. What we're doing in this case, we hope, is to try to get some answers. Journalists have been asking these questions, as you guys have been talking about, and not getting answers. So if you are a constituent calling your representative, do you have more leverage than a journalist might? We're going to find out.
And once we have the information, what do you propose that we do about it?
Well, one of the questions on the form is whether or not the congressperson would support a call for a public hearing about this issue. So one thing we might be able to do is to say, hey, our listeners called y'all and you said you'd be in favor of such a hearing. And if we can pull that all together, maybe there's a possibility for a hearing about transparency on this. That's one of the things that could come of this.
Well, I certainly hope that our listeners in the aggregate are more successful at getting answers from the government than we have been as a news organization, because so far we've hit a stone wall. John, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Bob.
John Keefe is WNYC's senior editor for data news and journalism technology.
Coming up, how the media treat victims of violence, both real and fabricated.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Monday, another in a seemingly endless series of shootings, this time at a Nevada middle school that left two dead, one the young perpetrator, the other teacher.
Mr. Lansbury, he went to go stop him and told him, put it down, the gun's, it's not worth it. Put it down, and he shot him in the heart.
Victims of such horrors struggle to create something worthwhile out of incalculable loss, and they often find they must learn how to manage the media to achieve their goals. The template for that kind of PR savvy was set back in 1999, after the massacre at Columbine High School, as Karen Duffin reports.
Littleton, Colorado.
Since you were just joining us, two young men apparently dressed in long black trench coats.
14 students that have been shot at Columbine High School.
My name is Craig Scott, and I am a survivor of the Columbine High School shooting. I also lost my sister, Rachel Joy Scott.
Craig was a student trapped in the library during the rampage. As he left the school, he confronted both his trauma and a country anxious to hear about it. Oprah called, Katie Couric called. He went on the Today Show 2 days after Columbine.
Kids with trench coats on, they came into the library and they shot Isaiah.
And then you played dead, Craig.
I just ended up laying on the floor. I was praying to God to give me courage.
Each time a high-profile tragedy occurs, the victims must decide, unsettled and unprepared, whether to share it.
So everything is on the fly, and that creates a lack of perspective about what are the consequences of my doing this or not doing this.
That's Steve Siegel from the Denver District Attorney's Office. He's worked with victims of Columbine, Aurora, Sandy Hook, and many other major tragedies. He says public relations professionals can spend years learning how to calculate how one interview might affect a court case, a relationship, a reputation, 5 weeks or 5 years down the road. It's like playing chess. One move affects the next. But victims don't calculate.
The vast majority of people who are willing to cooperate with the media, they are looking to try to create some sense out of a senseless act.
Craig Scott says talking to the press has been cathartic.
It was therapeutic to be able to talk and have people listen and have people be supportive.
Not everybody wants to do that, and I understand that.
That's Craig's father, Daryl Scott.
It has been not only therapeutic, but it's been a joy because it's like they're still with you as long as you share their memory.
Victims' advocates like Steve Siegel say that the line between an interview feeling cathartic and feeling painful or even re-victimizing is thin. Daryl understood this.
A lot of times, media wants to see emotion, and I personally just made a decision in the early days not to perform for the camera. I don't answer a lot of questions like, how did you feel when you heard that your daughter died? I always just say, you know, like any other parent would feel.
Sometimes victims use the media simply because it's the best way to spread the word.
The parents of Adam Walsh, who's been missing since yesterday noon.
You may recognize that voice.
I'm John Walsh. For 25 years, I've hunted fugitives all over the world. Tonight,
his son Adam was kidnapped from a shopping mall in 1981. He begged the press to cover the story, but he says they barely did. So 1 week into the search, John took some PR advice from an unlikely source.
The county coroner said raise the reward.
This PR-savvy coroner told John to use the most basic tool of PR, a news hook.
It'll intrigue the media. They'll show up, and it will reinvigorate Adam's case.
Sure enough, the local papers showed up. But 2 weeks later, Adam Walsh was found dead. John still believes that press attention could have brought Adam home alive. With reason. As host of America's Most Wanted, he's used the media to help capture over 1,200 criminals. Media pressure influences the decisions of police and politicians. And that influence is enough to make an otherwise press-shy person talk to the media.
I don't know. From my point of view, I didn't think I had any choice.
Bob Swartz is the father of internet activist Aaron Swartz. In 2011, the federal government charged Aaron with illegally downloading files over the MIT network. Amidst a very aggressive prosecution, Aaron committed suicide in January. And his death sparked an international outcry.
He was a computer prodigy, an online activist, co-founder.
He was an idealist who believed we had to live up to something.
He was a hero of the internet, but on Friday he was found hanged in his
Unlike the Scots, Bob Swartz doesn't like talking to the press.
Yeah, I mean, emotionally it's incredibly hard. And I try to erect some degree of emotional distance, but it's very difficult. I mean, what happened was just so shattering that one has a responsibility to make sure that these kinds of things don't happen again.
Bob's goals are ambitious: to make all academic literature free, to modify federal computing laws, and to make structural changes at MIT. So Bob did look for PR help, and he found a professional willing to advise him pro bono.
Well, I think he helped make sense, begin to make sense out of what was going on. You know, try to understand how to approach this. I mean, it was a completely new experience, and I didn't have a clue.
Bob is confronting institutions that have PR experience and deep pockets. But he has the advantages all victims and their families have. A public profile, deep, tragically earned credibility, and an emotional story that provokes interest in arcane-sounding issues. So he can use the media to help level the playing field. But moving from human interest to influence means learning how to attach a personal story to big issues and concrete solutions. In PR speak, this means learning how to bridge. John Walsh.
When I got involved in trying to force the FBI and the Justice Department to stop opposing the missing children's bill, I knew that I would only have a short amount of time on air, and I had to be succinct. I had to be articulate. I had to have a call to action. I better know what I was talking about. And I had to have something to say other than crying and pleading for Adam.
Walsh got his bill passed. And Bob Swartz, advocating after his son's suicide, helped prompt Congress to introduce a bill called Aaron's Law and MIT to conduct an internal review of its role in Aaron's case. Meanwhile, the Scots have also become advocates for a larger cause through an anti-bullying program they founded called Rachel's Challenge, based on the life and writings of Rachel Scott, Craig's sister who died at Columbine. They say it's the largest school assembly program in the country and that it's prevented at least 7 school shootings and 500 suicides. But the passion that gives these particular advocates their power also saps their strength. This isn't a product pitch. It's their lives, focused on the worst moment of their lives. John Walsh says,
I say it to every victim. You really don't have an obligation to carry forward. If you can't carry forward financially, if you can't carry forward emotionally, if you can't carry forward because it's destroying your family relationships, then don't do it.
Steve Siegel from the Denver District Attorney's Office says to remember, you can say no to the press. And if you say yes, you can set the parameters. He also says to be realistic about what you can actually get from talking to the media.
You know, you hear the word closure. Telling my story will bring me closure. It just really does not, in my experience, provide that. And what the real search is for incorporating this horrible experience into your current circumstances.
You know, look, my son's dead, and everything else is meaningless as compared to that, but you want to make sure that maybe some small amount of good can come out of such an immense tragedy.
People that say, Craig, how do you continue to talk about it and do the media? You know, it's like, you don't get it. Just join me for one trip and see what I see and then tell me how could I not do it.
Living in the spotlight is a challenging new reality for victims and their families. As Bob Swartz said, his son is dead. Everything after that is meaningless. But if they can learn how to play the media while factoring in their own limits and tolerance for the game, they may be able to find some meaning, even in the meaningless. For On the Media, I'm Karen Duffin.
In 2007, an employee of Halliburton's subsidiary KBR named Jamie Lee Jones alleged a brutal gang rape by her fellow employees in Iraq, an attack so violent as to disfigure her, and one for which the physical evidence, a rape kit, had mysteriously vanished. The narrative was tragically familiar. Woman victimized by men, then again by institutional malice, inflicted in this case by the U.S. government and, enough said, Halliburton. Here was Brian Ross on ABC's 2020.
But now, Jamie Lee Jones is coming forward tonight on 2020 to finally talk about what she says happened. A story of sexual brutality, corporate indifference, and government inaction.
Ross depicted an ongoing outrage, one which Jones could not even take to court because her employment contract with KBR mandated private arbitration. Her story was prominently featured in Hot Coffee, the HBO documentary about corporations denying the rights of citizens to petition the judiciary.
I went public because I wanted to bring awareness to the situation that there was a loophole in our justice system that needed to be fixed very quickly. If I could just, you know, get this out there, what happened to me, that maybe, you know, people would change the laws, somehow the laws would change.
Jones eventually did win the right to a trial, but by the 2011 proceedings, the media had done all the reporting they were going to do. In fact, the film Hot Coffee was released in the middle of the trial. Mother Jones reporter Stephanie Mensimer, who had written about Jamie Lee Jones and appeared in the movie, attended that premiere. The event got her freshly curious, and she launched an investigation, the results of which appeared in this month's Washington Monthly.
I went back to my office the next day. I thought, oh, well, I wonder what kind of smoking guns they've turned up. I wonder what sort of evil things Halliburton and KBR really did. And then when I took a look at the trial records, I literally, like, fell out of my chair. It was just so different from everything that we had been told about what happened to her. Jamie had been saying that she had been gang raped by at least five people. And there was no DNA of anybody except for one guy who never said he didn't have sex with her. He argued all along that he had consensual sex with her. There was no physical evidence that she'd been raped. There were photographs to show that she didn't have a bruise on her body. Her pectoral muscles were never torn. The rape kit was never lost. It was sent to the FBI lab in Quantico, and everything was evaluated. So all of that came out at the trial, and it completely undermined the story she had been telling for the previous couple of years in public.
There was testimony about previous allegations that Jones had made of rape.
I think that was the most troubling in some ways. When she first alleged that she'd been gang raped in Iraq, it was the fourth time in 5 years that she had told a doctor that she had been raped. It just seemed unlikely that someone would have that bad of luck.
Now, you went back to your editors at Mother Jones and said, well, I guess we better clarify the record. And your editor said, are you sure you want to do this?
I wanted to make sure I knew what I was getting myself into, because this was likely to be really controversial and we would be taking a lot of flack for it. But Mother Jones absolutely 100% supported publishing the story. So I did actually write a fairly lengthy online piece during the trial, basically a prediction that Jamie Lee Jones was going to lose, and here's why. It's hard to be a journalist and look at what I saw and not see that this is a good story. You know, you'd have to be a real ideologue not to recognize that there was news value in what I was finding.
Well, on the subject of ideologues, or just those who fear the consequences of this particular truth, what was the reaction?
I had one woman from, I think, I can't remember if it was from Jezebel or one of those sites, schooling me about how I clearly didn't understand the legal system. And other people saying, well, you know, it's possible that someone could be raped twice or three times or four times. And they just didn't want to believe that KBR wasn't the bad guy. You know, I got a fair amount of hate mail about that.
Stephanie, it would be very easy to accuse you in your early reporting of failing to do any kind of due diligence on Jamie Lee Jones's story. But nobody can accuse you of not correcting the record. You have done a very long piece in the Washington Monthly telling the story of Jamie Lee Jones from beginning to end. Have other outlets done the same? For example, ABC News, they reran the Brian Ross piece on the eve of the trial. Have they ever come back to say, Jamie Lee Jones, never mind?
Not as far as I know. I think they may have, like, on their website, reported very briefly that she lost at trial. But beyond that, they've never explored why she lost. The Houston Chronicle, to their credit, this was their local story, and they didn't even cover the trial. After she lost, this reporter, Mike Tolson, went back, and he wrote a fairly lengthy story about what happened. But even he, you know, will tell you that like 60% of what he wrote got cut out of the piece. You know, it was all very controversial. But as far as I know, he's the only reporter who's really taken a hard look at this.
Were there people in your journalistic life or in your private life who kind of winced at the idea of you correcting the record in this case?
I remember Susan Saladoff, the producer of Hot Coffee, she asked me, why now? Why do this? I think she felt like it would really kind of mess up Jamie's life. And she was right. I mean, I worried about that myself. But at the same time, you know, Jamie had testified before Congress, and she had apparently wrongfully accused someone of a crime. And I felt like there was a higher calling there.
She had her day in court. She lost. What became of her?
Well, KBR actually was very aggressive and went after her for filing a frivolous lawsuit. And they were able to get a ruling against her, ordering her to pay them $145,000 for their court costs. So when that happened, she filed bankruptcy. But she'd filed a workers' comp claim, got an annuity, I think it's like $175,000 of a workers' comp claim to compensate for her post-traumatic stress disorder. And that was protected in the bankruptcy. So she did end up coming out of it with some money. She's moved on. And I emailed her a little bit before the story came out to tell her what's coming. And she really doesn't ever want to talk about this again. You know, the one thing I believe about her is she really thought that she was helping other women. And I think she really wanted to be kind of Erin Brockovich. She was given an award by the Trial Lawyers Association at one point that had also been given to Erin Brockovich. And I think she really liked that idea.
Well, the irony of this story is she turned out to be Erin Brockovich because she did help women. Tell me about the Franken legislation.
Yeah, the Jamie Lee Jones Act. That's what it's called. Al Franken, as the junior senator from Minnesota, the first piece of legislation he was able to get passed was an amendment that barred the Pentagon from contracting with companies that would require a sexual assault victim to arbitrate her claims. And that was what KBR had in place. And that law opened the door for other contractors who'd been sexually harassed that they would be able to go to court and have a jury of their peers hear their claims. And arbitration clauses are really hard to get out of. So this was a big deal. I'm not sure how frequently it's been used since then, but it at least opens the possibility that women have a fighting chance to bring a real legitimate claim against an employer.
Stephanie, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Stephanie Mensimer is reporter for Mother Jones. She wrote a 10,000-word piece on the Jamie Lee Jones case for Washington Monthly. News is fast-paced and errors are collateral damage. We were struck in preparing for our Stephanie Mensimer interview, though, that ABC's Brian Ross was under no breaking news deadline pressure when recounting Jamie Lee Jones' version of events with barely a word of contradictory testimony.
Jamie Lee says she was taken by KBR security guards to a U.S. Army doctor who carried out a standard rape kit examination, and who, Jamie says, told her she had been raped by more than one man, gang raped.
Once again, though this segment was rebroadcast on the eve of the trial, ABC has not since aired so much as an update, much less a retraction. For Brian Ross stories, they might consider a form letter. The network's star investigative reporter has shelves full of trophies and many big scoops to his credit, notably uncovering the sexual misconduct that led to the resignation of former Congressman Mark Foley. But he's also amassed a series of damaging blunders. Here he is after the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting with Good Morning America's George Stephanopoulos.
I want to go to Brian Ross here, because, Brian, you've been looking at investigating the background of Jim Holmes here. You found something that might be significant.
There is a Jim Holmes of Aurora, Colorado page on the Colorado Tea Party site as well, talking about him joining the Tea Party last year. Now, we don't know if this is the same Jim Holmes, but it's Jim Holmes of Aurora, Colorado.
Nope. Different James Holmes, tarring an individual and a political faction in one fell swoop. Ross likes swooping in on big stories with big ramifications. In 2001, early in the Bush administration's build-up for the war in Iraq, he linked Saddam Hussein to anthrax attacks in the United States based on erroneous claims from anonymous sources. In 2007, he passed along the allegation of an ex-CIA officer that only 30 seconds of waterboarding yielded key intelligence from an important terrorism suspect, a single-source claim that helped inform the widespread public acceptance of torture in interrogation, except that CIA documents later proved the suspect was waterboarded at least 83 times. We asked ABC News why the only follow-up to Ross's Jamie Lee Jones story was an ABCNews.com article about the court verdict, a story that never mentioned Ross's TV coverage. ABC offered a statement that did not address the question and declined repeated requests for a direct answer. The stakes of TV news corner cutting aren't always so dire. For instance, Conan O'Brien's late-night talk show has an occasional segment called Media Reacts, featuring local TV news anchors displaying their brands of fiercely independent journalism.
But is it time for dogs to have a social network of their own?
Is it time for dogs to have a social network of their own? Is it time
a fetching for dogs question. To have a get it? Fetching. Last week, KWWL of Waterloo, Iowa, was one station showcased in Conan's montage. This time, the story was about actor Mike Myers of Austin Powers fame expecting a second child.
Mike Myers says, yeah, baby.
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 Dan Schillinger is the news director of KWWL. Dan, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Obviously, 20 stations don't independently contrive exactly the same intro to the Mike Myers story. How does it happen that KWWL used this line and everybody else as well?
I can't speak for the other stations, but obviously we all subscribe to various news services. We subscribe to the Associated Press. We subscribe to a service from NBC. This story was a CNN story, and CNN sent out the copy with the joke. We all copy and pasted it. And I think what's happened over the last few years, as we keep asking producers and writers to do more and more work, but we don't devote any more resources, so they're forced to kind of find shortcuts. And one of the easiest shortcuts is I'm just going to copy and paste this story that was sent to me and drop it into my newscast.
Look, no animals were harmed in the making of that segment. No viewer was exactly misled. But you don't like rip and read. Why?
I remember distinctly the first time they brought a computer into my newsroom and somebody showed me how easy it was to copy and paste an AP story and drop it into my newscast. And my immediate thought was, oh my God, I've just cut 50% of my work time. And then after doing it for a while, I realized, oh, this is a bad thing. Journalists are supposed to write, not copy and paste.
Now, one of the reasons the Conan segments are so hilarious is that given the same line to read, about half of the talent really does a horrible job of selling the joke. How did your anchor do in reading the yeah, baby line?
I thought she did fine. She's seen the movies. She gets the joke.
What was her reaction when she saw herself in the montage?
You know, anybody in a local market like this is kind of delighted to see themselves in a national showcase. This is not the first time we've been in that particular showcase, by the way.
A two-time winner.
Yeah, exactly.
Dan, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dan Schillinger is news director for KWWL, Waterloo, Iowa. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Zach Spencer and Megan Tian, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.